Welcome, and thanks for listening to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Jeffrey Aletta and Steven Spellman of NMDP Be the Match and the Center for International Blood and Marrow Transplant Research, or CIBMTR, which is a research partnership between NMDP Be the Match and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Together, we examine the current state of the science behind selecting a suitable donor for allogeneic transplant, considering how access and availability has changed over time. We discuss the latest research on HLA matching, the evolution of alternative stem cell sources, and efforts to close equity gaps and ensure a donor for all potential transplant patients. To read bios on our guests and access additional resources related to today's episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. This is part one in a two-part discussion. All right, so today I'm joined by Steven Spellman and Dr. Jeffrey Aletta. Welcome to Explore Cell Therapy.
Thanks for the invite, Sam.
Yeah, thanks.
Of course. Today we're talking about a topic that's very important for both access and equity in allogeneic hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and that is the ever-evolving state of the science of HLA matching and selecting the best donor or stem cell source. And Steve just published a paper on this topic in Hematology 2022, which is the American Society of Hematology's educational program tied to the annual ASH conference. So Steve, I'm going to start with you, but Dr. Aletta, feel free to jump in at any time. Tell me a little bit about the goals of this paper, sort of the rationale, and, you know, why now? Why in 2022 do we need this look at the current state of things?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sam. So the overall session, the educational session that this is included in is called Are Alternative Donors Now Mainstream in Allogeneic Transplant? And so first, I think we should define what an alternative donor is. So your ideal donor is generally a matched sibling donor that it's fully HLA matched to the patient. Now, that's not going to be an option that's available for everybody. So the alternative donors then turn to mismatched related graft sources, such as a haploidentical donor, or unrelated donor sources, whether they're matched or mismatched, and that's including unrelated donors, adult donors, or cord blood. And so the session includes a couple other speakers that will be covering specific topics around use of mismatched unrelated donors and some new novel strategies that have been developed in recent years, as well as another kind of comparing and contrasting outcomes of haploidentical transplant to umbilical cord blood transplant. And the topic that I was given is, what is complete HLA match in 2022? Well, we could talk about the high resolution matching and getting to an extremely high level of match using alternative graft sources, which I did, went into that level of detail, but really wanted to focus the topic around ability to find an alternative donor. So in the event of not having a matched sibling donor, it's really what are those alternative choices that are available and how do you optimize the selection of those within each of those different donor type categories, as well as talking a bit about kind of the hierarchy of donor choice. And so that was really the impetus of the way that I approached the paper, and hopefully that's how it came across as well in the written version. That was kind of the main impetus there. But the main takeaway from the paper is that there are donors available for essentially every patient at this point. The donor availability barrier to transplant has essentially gone away at this point in time. And that's because of a lot of innovation that's occurred over the last decade in the use of mismatched graft sources. And that was mainly in, well, cord blood being a well-tolerated mismatched graft source that's been well-established. But now new transplant procedures that have been used mainly in the mismatched related donor space, so haploidentical donors that allow for broader use of that graft source that in a safe and effective manner. And now that is starting to transition a bit into use in the mismatched unrelated donor space as well. And so, and showing some benefits and ability to get away from the HLA barrier that had been well established in past years. In essentially using calcineurin inhibitor-based GVHD prophylaxis, because that's the main risk. One of the main risks of transplantation is an alloreactive graft versus host disease effect. Well, we want a graft versus leukemia effect, so you need some alloreactivity that's there, but you need to balance that. So balancing the GVHD with potential for relapse risk as well. So that kind of yin and yang of transplantation. How do we get good GVL without having overwhelming GVHD, without also, you know, increasing your relapse risk? So there's some great new approaches, mainly post-transplant cyclophosphamide or abatacept in the mismatched unrelated donor space that allow for that more safe and effective use of those graft sources. And that really expands access to all patients in need. And so really wanted to emphasize that as part of this article.
Hey, Steve, great job. And you're, as always, very humble. This is actually a great paper that you wrote. It's a fantastic review and really is a nice review for kind of fellows and even advanced practitioners all the way up to, those people who do immunogenics and immunobiology and with regards to their everyday research. So really, hats off. It's a great, great, great review. I would like to emphasize a couple of things that Steve's mentioning. Clearly we're in a different era now with regards to the ability to provide a donor for all patients. And it used to be that we had to, think about HLA as a significant barrier. I think we still do. And as Steve mentioned, there is a cadence in terms of the algorithm that we use with regards to selecting donors. But post-transplant Cy or post-transplant cyclophosphamide has clearly been a game changer in terms of being able to hurdle the HLA barrier, both from a mismatched unrelated donor perspective, but certainly in the haploidentical donor perspective. So HLA is seemingly less of a barrier. Obviously we clearly believe it is a very important issue in terms of transplant. What do I mean by that? I think, one is in the matched unrelated donor setting clearly has implications in terms of graft versus host disease risk and morbidity and mortality. But also with regards to mediating some form of graft versus leukemia, I wish I could say here in 2022, we knew the exact mechanisms of graft versus leukemia and tumor and the role specifically of HLA in that, but we're still learning. And as Steve alluded to, it's that holy grail in terms of being able to separate graft versus host disease from graft versus leukemia, which I think, at least with regards to the next 5 or 10 years, is probably going to be a combination of cell therapy and maybe immunotherapy on top of, who is in fact the best alternative donor to use.
Wow. No, that's, yeah, there's so much going on in this space, I feel like, and it's very hard to keep up, especially with our listenership, which is sort of a joint transplant and hematology oncology audience as well. So when they're thinking about this concept of donor availability and how these graft sources get selected for their patients as they refer them on to transplant centers, how does this concept of the evolving hierarchy of optimal, stem cell graft sources, if you will, how does that relate to the concept of overall donor availability? And how does that relate to equity? I think would be great things to touch on if you could.
Yeah. Well, so I could jump in, and so to talk a bit about just overall access, that's something that's laid out in the paper. So with a matched sibling donor, so being your gold standard of a donor, being available for, let's just say, approximately 30% of the population. That's just based on kind of an average 2.5 children estimate, but we know that varies from about 15% to over 30% for certain populations. But for the VAT for the 70% that don't have that readily available, well, then you start to look at the alternatives. When we look at matched unrelated donors, so using kind of a traditional standard of an 8 of 8 match, considering matching at HLA A, B, C, and DRB1, that varies by race and ethnicity, with African Americans in the U.S. having the lowest possible lowest likelihood of having a matched unrelated donor available on the registry. And with that limited availability, what you also get is less choice of those donors. So they can tend to be older or maybe less optimal from a selection standpoint. So when you get into the alternative graft sources, that's where you get potentially more choice. Sure, you're able to use a haploidentical related family member, so you have a 50% chance of matching any of your siblings or any of your biological siblings, as well as being a half match to biological parents as well as biological offspring. So there's a fair amount of choice there, but that can also be limited by potential exposure that those patients have had to blood products that lead to HLA antibody development, which may limit their ability to use that limited donor pool in the family. And that's where alternative or unrelated graft sources really kind of open up that ability to expand access to broader populations. So I had mentioned African Americans having a 29% chance of having a fully matched unrelated donor available. When we start to consider mismatched graft sources, so whether that's cord blood or mismatched unrelated donor or even a mismatched haplo, we're well over 99% for all patients having a viable donor available for transplant. And when we start to talk about equity and as access to transplant, as well as equity in outcomes, we have seen improvements across the board in use of alternative graft sources. So when we compare back to matched sibling donors, right now we really don't see a difference between a matched sibling donor and a matched unrelated donor in the context of 1 year overall survival. And that's looking at that's real world evidence from the CIBMTR. When we look at alternative graft sources and compared to both matched sibling donors and matched unrelated donors, there is a bit of a step down in, well, an increase in mortality risk post-transplant, but it's been shrinking year over year. And so we're seeing better outcomes across the board in all graft sources. So that's been really encouraging as well. And as we continue to refine these approaches, so really working towards optimization of the transplant approach, so whether that's the selection of the donor or in the transplant procedure itself, we're seeing lower rates of toxicity, lower rates of mortality and morbidity across the board for graft sources based on different donor types that are available. So we're kind of at this point, floating all boats, which is great. And are we going to be on par with matched sibling donors as the gold standard across the board? At some point, I think we definitely are, as we start to learn more about the donor characteristics, whether that's HLA or non-HLA characteristics that really optimize those outcomes. And when we start to think about a larger alternative donor pool to be able to draw from, you can really start to enhance that. So whether that's considering younger donor age or other factors that may be influential for particular outcomes. So yeah, I think it's a bright future. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, so I echo everything you say, Steve. I'm going to emphasize a couple of things. I think best outcomes for patients are when they get referred to a transplant center in the most expeditious time, and obviously have a donor for sure. I know that we're kind of focusing a little bit on the provision of a donor, but really, I think in terms of the community physicians, it's really important to be in contact with the transplant center when in fact they have patients who have transplantable diseases. And it used to be that a lot of times there wasn't an available donor, and so sometimes that became a barrier to referral to a transplant center, but certainly that's not the case in terms of everything that Steve had just mentioned and we've been talking about. But I think there are other barriers that are perceived in terms of transplant referrals. I think one of them is, you know, these patients do horrible. You know, the transplant patients, or a transplant is the last ditch effort for survival, and that's just clearly not the case. Yes, they can in fact be the means for best patient outcomes, but not all transplant patients, for example, die. I mean, there's a lot of supportive care in the last 10 years that we have that enables better patient outcomes. So community physicians should know those. And at the NMDP, we clearly have guidelines with regards to transplant disease indications on our website that can help facilitate to know what transplant-related diseases are. Certainly, we have patient services and navigators that can be contacted as well in terms of that. The second thing, though, is in terms of barriers to referral. So I think those can be kind of grouped into three different pots. One is the patient barriers, the kind of the physician barriers, and the center barriers. Patient barriers, I think Steve alluded to those, kind of the equality and equity of access. Yes, now with these alternative donors, we have the ability to provide donors to just about everyone, and based upon what Steve had reviewed for alternative donor forms. Obviously, there are socioeconomic barriers for patients with regards to insurance and education level and also income level. And these are unfortunate realities that still exist in 2022 America. And we certainly can help with that in terms of providing patient services for those patients who require those needs. And then we talk a little bit about physician barriers and understanding what transplantable disease indications are and when to refer patients to transplants. Here at MDP, we have a program called HLA Today that can help facilitate the HLA typing for patients prior to being referred. And that's a great service that transplant community physicians can utilize. In addition to that, then, are the barriers of the institutions, right? Here we are, and being a transplant physician, I can say this. Sometimes we operate in this somewhat of a vacuum in terms of the reality of outside of the hospital walls, and we don't appreciate all that our patients have to go through in order to get to us. So this gets into a little bit more of those social determinants of health that dramatically impact the ability to get to a transplant center as well. So that's one thing. The second thing is typing, and in the article, Steve has done a great job in terms of, you know, laying out the history of typing, of HLA typing. Used to be that we did kind of what are called low resolution or antigen level typing, and now we're doing high resolution or allele typing. And using technology that's really quite mind-boggling, and I think I'm going to transition here to Steve to tell us a little bit about that technology and how that has influenced typing and post-transplant outcomes.
Yeah, Jeff, I'd be happy to kind of carry that forward. So we've had a world of change over the last 30 years in the field, and originally starting with trying to understand, HLA in and of itself, this is kind of new science when we think about it. I mean, it's really been the last 50 years where we've really started to understand this better and develop new techniques to better characterize the HLA and what is important to match for donors and recipients. And I'll go back to kind of an effort that started years ago, back in before my time at National Marrow Donor Program, Be the Match, that was a project that really kicked off with support from the Office of Naval Research to develop the methodologies to do D DNA-based testing. At the time that this kicked off, at the time that the program started in 87, techniques were mainly serologic. So you're using antibodies that have been developed mainly from multiparous females, blood donors that had developed HLA against the fetus, or HLA antibodies against the fetus, and those could be used to characterize HLA. This was all cell-based assays, antibody-based toxicities, where you're looking for binding and cell death. Kind of a low resolution, very low resolution evaluation, mainly at class one. There were techniques that were starting to develop for DNA-based testing at class two, but they were pretty rudimentary at the time. So this project that was kicked off in 94 really was to expand our understanding and of HLA alleles, so at the DNA-based level, developing the methodologies to characterize that, and determine what level of matching was really important and what genes were important to match. Because back at the beginning, we were only testing for HLA A, B, and DRB1. So class one was HLA A and B, class two was DRB1. You would do mixed lymphocytes cultures, which would kind of bring in some of the other mismatch that was there that maybe wasn't well understood, and you could see the alloreactivity, but didn't really understand, have insight into the underlying mechanisms. And so this project was kicked off to do high resolution typing at class one HLA A, B, and C. So C being an antigen that wasn't, or a gene that wasn't being evaluated in most transplant settings in the mid 90s. And then extending into class two and looking at DRB1, DRB3, 4, 5, DQ, A and B, and DP, A and B. So this project started in 94. The first manuscript that came out of it was in 2000. It took, well, actually 2004. It took a little while to be able to review all of that data, understand that we were accurate in the way that we were characterizing the mismatches, and started to gain some more insights. So really getting the first insights into the impact of HLA-C, which now we understand is a critical gene to match for transplant success, as well as kind of a better understanding of kind of class two mismatching what are the genes that are important for overall survival, mainly, is what the focus was of those analyses, DRB1 being the most important, but then also having contributions from HLA-DPB1 and new insights that are coming from that and ways to characterize those alleles. So one of the things that we've learned over the years, well, which was pretty clear at the time that this typing was kind of developing, was that HLA-DP was not in very tight linkage disequilibrium with the remainder of the HLA alleles. And so DP was kind of difficult to match or didn't match very commonly. So we saw mismatches in about 75% of transplants. But thanks to some pivotal work from other groups like Katarina Fleischauer in Essen, and some in vitro observations that they had in mixed lymphocyte cultures, kind of showing that DP maybe comes in a few different flavors. You could kind of characterize it based on the T cell epitopes, and classify alloreactivity based on that, and showing that that also impacts outcomes. So not just matching at HLA A, B, C, and DRB1 being very important, that 8 of 8 standard, but if you could bring along DP permissive and permissive or matched, that you could also have better overall survival outcomes with a reduction in graft versus host disease, which is really important. DQB1 has also been important to match. The more recent studies showing some associations with acute GVHD risk, but we've yet to show an impact on overall survival in the calcineurin inhibitor-based GVHD prophylaxis transplants that have been done to date. But again, with the new innovative approaches that are being adopted in both the matched and the mismatched space, so post-transplant cyclophosphamide being the most common, we're going to have to revisit a lot of this and understand whether there's particular combinations of mismatch that lead to better outcomes, better disease control, things along those lines. So good news is we have a great system for characterizing HLA matching today and to be able to search for donors. So we know what is important to match and what regions of the genes are important to characterize for that matching purpose. So we can do that. We can effectively search. And now it's starting to learn from new experience. So what are we going to see in the next few years as far as the impact of various types of mismatching and ways that we could potentially even select for optimal mismatch? There may be genes that we want to mismatch that lead to better relapse control in certain settings without an increase in the graft versus host disease risk. And that would be ideal, especially in certain diseases, like the vast majority of diseases that are currently transplanted with allogeneic transplant are acute myelogenous leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and myelodysplastic syndrome. All have a pretty high risk of relapse post-transplant. It's the number one factor for treatment failure. Mm-hmm. So if we can come up with or start to understand the better way to select donors to minimize that relapse risk, that would be huge. And that's getting to this donor optimization phase of the approach. So now that we have a broader choice among our donors, how do we select that best donor that's going to really give us a kind of a more of a precision medicine approach to selecting the donor to understand the better outcome based on the type of disease that they have? So in a malignant disease setting, wanting to have better disease control, but then maybe in a non-malignant setting, there's other mismatches that just aren't tolerated well. And so we'll want to avoid those in that case, where you're not as concerned about the disease coming back, you're more concerned about the morbidity caused by the transplant procedure. So lots of new data to come in the future.
Yeah, it's really exciting stuff. And quite frankly, I always am kind of overwhelmed a little bit about all these permissive and non-permissive and having to go back. And so a paper like Steve's is very helpful because it reviews those concepts.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for the second half of this episode, where our guests take a deeper look at optimizing donor stem cell source selection while looking forward at the future of transplant.